Hello, everyone. I'm Amanda Balbi, Associate Editor at Consultant and Consultant360.com. Today, I'm joined by Dr. T.S. Dharmarajan, who is the Vice Chairman of the Department of Medicine, Clinical Director of the Division of Geriatrics, and the Program Director of the Geriatric Medicine Fellowship Program at the Wakefield Campus of Montefiore, the University Hospital of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. Dr. Dharmarajan will speak with us today about approaches to treating diabetes in older adults.
Thank you, Amanda. It's a pleasure to be able to do this for Consultant 360. As you already stated, my talk is going to focus on clinical practice guidelines in older adults with diabetes mellitus. The information is extrapolated from the American Geriatric Society guidelines, the post-acute and long-term care medicine, formerly known as AMDA guidelines, and also the Diabetic Association guidelines published in Diabetes Care. I will focus largely on the approach to diabetes in the geriatric population rather than on the specific drugs that are used to treat diabetes. There are no financial disclosures of any kind that I need to disclose. Let's begin with the criteria for the diagnosis of diabetes. They are a fasting blood glucose at or over 126 milligrams per deciliter, or a 2-hour plasma glucose of over 200. And this is typically following a glucose or food load equal to 75 grams of glucose. Diabetes can also be diagnosed by a random hemoglobin A1C, and I will refer to it for the duration of this talk as A1C, of at or over 6.5. Pre-diabetes can be diagnosed with a hemoglobin A1C ranging from 5.8 to 6.4. Who should you be screening for diabetes if one is asymptomatic? Any adult who weighs over a BMI of 25 kilograms per meter square and or those with additional risk factors, including a history of physical inactivity, first degree relatives with diabetes, certain high risk race or ethnicities such as African Americans and Latinos and Asian Americans, hypertension, those with an HDL cholesterol that is below 35 or a high triglyceride level over 250, women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, and those known to have a prior A1C above 5.7, in other words, they were pre-diabetics. A history of cardiovascular disease or stroke should also prompt screening. Screening begins at the age of 45 years, and if the results are normal, repeat testing is recommended at 3-year intervals. I will begin with just a mention of the strategies and concepts that are used to address diabetes in older adults. Number one, it should be patient-centered, looking at patients' preferences, literacy, and cultural barriers. It is usually through utilization of care systems. Along with diabetes, one looks at several other associated morbidity. Examples include hypertension and hyperlipidemia, and also their lifestyle, including smoking prevention. We have to also keep in mind the location of care. By that I mean, is it a hospital, is it a community, or is it a long-term care facility such as a nursing home, acute or subacute, or custodial care? We should look at aspects of adherence and barriers, and importantly, all stages of life. In particular, we are asked to tailor treatment to the vulnerable patient. And what is a vulnerable patient? These are patients who have cognitive dysfunction on top of the list. And by that, we mean anybody with either mild cognitive impairment or certain degrees of dementia. We look at the presence of psychosis in such patients or the presence of depression, which is said to be more common in diabetics. These groups have to be handled somewhat differently. There are also older patients who have ethnic or cultural beliefs or religious beliefs, and accordingly will want differences in management. And lastly, there is a certain degree of vulnerability when there is food insecurity. This term refers to the unreliable availability of nutritious food, such as in those who are homeless or illiterate, and importantly, suggests that some resort to means that are not socially acceptable to obtain food. These patients who have food insecurity need to be handled differently. As always, in the case of a diabetic, you like to have a good history about the duration, if that is known. Oftentimes, the patient is unaware of the duration. A history of prior hospitalizations, particularly for ketoacidosis or hypoglycemia or hyperosmolar states. The general eating patterns, importantly, physical activity and changes in weight over time. In addition to the blood pressure and fundoscopy, which are routinely performed in such patients, it is important to do a thyroid examination, a good examination of the skin, and in particular of the feet. The feet are subject to inspection, examination of vasculature, the deep tendon reflexes, proprioception, vibration, and monofilament sensation. The typical basic tests will include, in addition to routine tests, such as blood count and electrolytes, renal function, lipid profiles, thyroid function, and a urine examination not only for protein but albumin-creatinine ratio. Now, what I have just stated is really offered to every diabetic. In addition, I'm going to mention certain considerations in older people. Smoking cessation is important in everybody, but it's also prudent to ask these patients as to whether they ever smoked in the past. A past history of heavy smoking, although not current smokers, is going to provide additional risk besides diabetes and hypertension and hyperlipidemia. So as I've stated, the evaluation for cognitive function and depression screening and anxiety is considered important. Blood pressure control today in diabetics is recommended to a goal of at or below 140 by 90. If the values are lower than this and the patient is stable, there needs to be no effort to raise the blood pressure values. But in the very old, such as patients who are 75 or 80, a systolic blood pressure of 150 or rarely even 160 may be acceptable. Renal function ought to be measured through an estimate of the glomerular filtration rate every 6 months and quarterly when the estimated GFR is below 45 cc per minute. In such cases, a referral to a nephrologist might be prudent. It is essential to note this estimated GFR because dosage adjustment of medications appropriate to renal function becomes a consideration. Besides the routine electrolytes, it is prudent to get a hemoglobin or hematocrit. These might be lower because of kidney disease, albumin levels, calcium, phosphorus, and parathormone at least once. All diabetics, particularly the old, should be offered pneumococcal vaccination, both the 23-valent and the 13-valent, influenza vaccine annually, herpes zoster vaccine, tetanus toxoid, and in most cases, tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, and a consideration for hepatitis B vaccine. In all aspects of management, much importance is provided to lifestyle and addressing lifestyle-related factors. So let's start with medical nutrition in such patients. Today, the term diabetic diet or no added sugar and the use of restricted diets are generally not encouraged. It is important that a diabetic patient eat the normal number of meals every day. And there is also no such thing as a one-size-fits-all eating pattern for every diabetic. So one of the things that we are expected today, based on current guidelines, to offer is a healthful eating pattern with a variety of nutrient-dense foods. And what is meant by nutrient-dense refers to items with few calories or fewer calories, fewer fats, more complex carbohydrates, more lean protein, vitamins and minerals, and healthy fats. Some examples, and I'll give you one in the fruit family, probably high on the list is blueberries. If I take the vegetable family, high on the list is kale, even better than spinach, often referred to as king kale. In the fish family, salmon. And I always like to mention the family of nuts. Why nuts? Because nuts are low in glycemic index, and a handful of nuts once or twice a day also help to address lipid management in the right direction. So you want variety, you want whole grains, legumes, vegetables, fruits, lean meats, lean poultry, and fish where possible. In addition, a diet always goes with physical activity. A little activity is better than none. Just standing is better than sitting. You burn a few more calories when you stand, and you can even do something known as stand walking, which means you move your feet as you stand, or you can sit in a chair, as happens to many older people who are incapable of having walks. You can sit in a chair and do some kind of exercise, either with your hands, including resistance training, like pulling on items that force you to contract your muscles, or you can use stationary bikes where you sit in a chair and you just use the legs to pedal if the legs are capable of performing this task. Where a person is capable of walking, the safest exercise is walking, and the current recommendation is about 150 minutes per week or more, divided into 30 minutes a day times 5 to 6 or even 7 days a week. If you can walk briskly, you would generally walk a mile in about 15 minutes. Now, this is the minimum. This activity does not have to be done at the same time, 30 minutes every day. It can be broken down into 10 minutes times 3 or 15 minutes times 2 based on the patient's comfort level. Now, in general, it's a good idea to tell patients to use the activity in the form of exercise that is most loved by them. Some would ask you, can I swim? Can I dance? All of them are acceptable. Exercise is considered to be something that is done in a programmed manner, repeatedly or in a pattern. And a lot of patients will tell you that they are always active at home. Our routine activities always force us to walk a certain extent. But programmed, repetitive activity of a certain nature done in a regular fashion, other than referring to your lifestyle, is generally what we mean by exercise. It's a specific form of structured physical activity. It's very important in diabetics that we ask this question, and then we try to help the patient to the extent that they can participate. All patients, including demented patients who are sometimes in a facility, benefit from exercise. Now, let's go to the A1C testing. If you remember, a while ago, we used to refer to a test known as fructosamine. That's no longer in place. Today, we see A1 testing as an opportunity that is utilized to screen for diabetes and to assess the degree of control. Typically, it is performed twice a year in diabetics who meet treatment goals, and every 3 months or quarterly in those diabetics who are not at goals. But it's important to know that here A1C levels are affected by several factors that affect the life of the red cell, such as any form of hemolytic anemia, iron deficiency anemia, chronic kidney disease, thyroid illness, alcoholism, the excessive use of vitamin C, and on and on, besides individual variations that occur relating to heritability or genetic influences. So all said and done, A1C levels are the best that we have, but can vary from person to person. Having said that, with the A1C goal, a great goal for most healthy adults who are in their 60s would be below 7. But it is fairly consistent now with most organizations asking for less stringent goals. In other words, the hemoglobin A1C target is not specific for every individual, but based on a few factors that includes comorbidity, life expectancy, quality of life, and patient's own feelings about management. So in a person with Alzheimer's disease who has got advanced dementia, tight control would not be necessary at all. And such a patient would have a hemoglobin A1C somewhere between 7.5 and 8.5 or even higher than 8.5, as opposed to the healthy 65-year-old adult who has very little comorbidity and has a life expectancy of 15 or 20 years or more. Such patients would have a target of somewhere between 6.5 and 7. The attempt to make the hemoglobin A1C target below 6.5 is hardly in place today. So ultimately, you will take into account the presence of comorbidity, the life expectancy, the presence or absence of vascular illness, the patient's attitude, and importantly, resources and support systems. If this is an older diabetic who lives alone, who has no help at home, tight control would be not recommended, as opposed to somebody who has enough people to seek help in the environment that he or she lives. The reason for this is the recognition today that most patients who come to the emergency room of hospitals have changed from previously hyperglycemia to today hypoglycemia in the older population. A large number of older diabetics come into the hospital with hypoglycemia relating to a variety of factors, including attempts at tight control or missing a meal. I'd already mentioned about meals and the fact that some people do not have access to food. They take their insulin but do not eat. Secondly, the presentation of hypoglycemia is different in the old compared to the young. The typical young diabetic would present with palpitations, sweating, and what appears to be an anxiety state. The older patient presents with hypoglycemia with largely abnormalities in mental status. A person who becomes quieter, a person who may be drowsy, who may not express any complaints, and in his worst form, it might be coma or a seizure. Because the patient does not complain, such patients are hardly recognized. And so older patients who are diabetic, who are on anti-diabetic drugs, particularly insulin, depend on others around them to recognize their problem. This presentation in the old is termed neuroglycopenic, as opposed to the younger people who present with adrenergic manifestations. As patients get older, there is a progressive hypoglycemia associated autonomic failure, and so their manifestations are more difficult to recognize because they might just become lethargic and quieter, drowsy, and it's worse situation, either stuprose or comatose. So the current literature suggests that intensive glucose-lowering treatment in type 2 diabetics doubles the risk of hypoglycemia and is associated with over-testing and over-treatment, and thereby waste and patient burden. Due to fear of hypoglycemia, recommendations today are for less stringent management of diabetes in the old, even more so since strict control has not been associated with better life expectancy and better outcomes, while they do eat up additional resources. As for the case for aspirin, today the recommendation is to use aspirin purely for secondary prevention in diabetes and not for primary prevention. Today, aspirin is used in a range of 81 to 325 milligrams a day for older adults with diabetes for secondary prevention, but is not recommended for primary prevention of cerebrovascular or cardiovascular disease. We talked about blood pressure control. The JNC guideline doesn't particularly promote the use of ACE inhibitors or ARBs, but they're perfectly acceptable. And should you have renal dysfunction, and a tendency to hyperkalemia, these patients ought to be followed more closely. Diuretics are perfectly acceptable. There is emphasis placed on the treatment of dyslipidemias with statins. Typically, diabetics in the 40 to 75 year age group ought to be treated with statins, but not necessarily to target levels. Your question would be, what do we do with those diabetics who have dementia? The benefit of statins in such patients outweighs the risks of using statins in demented people. So in general today, unless the dementia is advanced, there is an inclination to use statins. So if I looked at an older diabetic who comes to me, by the time the patient has been evaluated, we should have looked at the cognitive status. We should screen for depression, which is more common in diabetics. We should ask a question about falls, which might relate to glucose control. And we should also ask diabetics about urinary incontinence, which appears to be more common in such patients. For lipid control, the treatment today is statins. The use of fibrates for using high triglyceride levels does not have a strong recommendation. If triglycerides are high, besides statins, the proper approach would be to address carbohydrate intake. So in addition to the physical activity, the diet should include a reduction of saturated and trans fats, an increase in fiber and plant sterols, and omega-3 fatty acids. And if they are hypertriglyceridemic, a decrease in carbohydrate intake. The use of niacin is also at this time not known to improve outcomes when combined with statins. A separate comment that should be made is that the use of what was known in the past called sliding scale insulin therapy is generally discouraged today. What is sliding scale therapy? Sliding scale refers to the fact that with every meal, a glucose level is checked and insulin is administered. It is a reactive approach. The correct approach today would be the use of basal insulin or a long-acting insulin once a day, and the use of prandial insulin, in other words, small doses of a short-acting insulin along with meals, without necessarily having to check the glucose level at every meal. This is known as the basal insulin or the basal bolus approach. That is the recommendation today. The number of times a patient's blood sugar ought to be checked through finger sticks is highly controversial. There is very poor evidence at this time based on studies to support a specific number, and the best advice is to individualize to that patient's needs. When the patient is acutely ill in a hospital setting, the blood sugar will be checked more often. You'll be surprised to hear that a diabetic can be managed in the community or the nursing home setting with a few blood sugars done a week. Could be 2 days in the morning at breakfast, 2 days in the afternoon, and 2 days in the evening, for a total of just 6 blood checks in a week, perhaps for 1 week and a month. However, when the patient is a new diabetic, new to insulin therapy, or has an intercurrent illness, the blood sugar should be checked more often. So the frequency of blood sugar check today, there is no good standard recommendation. You'll have to individualize this for each patient. So the sliding scale insulin is outmoded according to the Beers criteria and according to most guidelines today. Towards the end, what I'm going to say is your ultimate decision on how aggressive or how not so intense you would like to be in terms of treatment, and I'm talking about insulin and all the drugs that you're using, you take into account the patient characteristic and healthy status or health status. The more healthy you are, the more likely you're going to target an A1C goal that is in the 7 to 7.5 or lower, and you assume that this is the kind of patient who has a long life expectancy. The more the patient has a complex illness with poor health, and has a limited life expectancy, your goal will be below 8.5, and you perhaps may not want to repeat this A1C test every few months. So that is depending on the health of the patient. The second thing is the location of the patient. Patients who come into the hospital are ill, will need their blood sugar checked and their hemoglobin A1C perhaps once. When they get into a skilled nursing facility, you might check the blood sugar more often until glycemic control is optimized, but A1C will not have to be repeated because they were just in the hospital. And you will then determine in the same manner based on life expectancy and comorbidity as to what your target should be. Patients towards the end of life have no role in A1C testing, and you really need to keep them comfortable to avoid, most importantly, symptomatic hyperglycemia and hypoglycemia, whether they are symptomatic or not. The last thing you want is that the patient should not have a catastrophic outcome just based on low blood sugar. The comparison of sliding scale with basal bolus was actually determined in a study that was published in 2016. I actually was the principal investigator, and it showed that you could shift patients from what was the former sliding scale insulin to the proactive basal bolus approach in a safe manner, and that your blood sugars will not only be controlled somewhat better, but it is a safe thing to make this transition. So in summary, what I have suggested to you that older diabetics should be handled somewhat differently from the young, in the sense that we tend to keep the hemoglobin A1C targets not as close to the ideal 6.5. You keep them at a level that is commensurate with the patient's comorbidity, cognitive status, any other psychiatric illnesses such as schizoaffective disorders, and life expectancy. It is important that along with the diabetes control, you look at many of the comorbid associated disorders. They go hand in hand, in particular hypertension and hyperlipidemia and obesity. A lifestyle is encouraged at all stages. A diet should not be restrictive. In fact, the older you are, you encourage patients to eat and you provide them choice and address the quality of life.
Thank you so much, Dr. Dharmarajan.
And thank you.